Welcome, everyone. We are going to start out today with a public hearing on House Bill 2977. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2977 would establish a law enforcement Medal of Honor. By establishing that Medal of Honor, it also establishes the Governor's Commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor and the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor account and continuously appropriates money in the account to the Governor.
Thank you. We have signed up for this Ken Johnson and Dan Swift. And Mr. Campbell, you're welcome to join them. Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator, members of this committee. My name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I'm here to testify briefly on this bill and try to explain why we in the law enforcement community feel this is a very important thing for not only us, but for our surviving family members. I've been a police officer. It'll be 20 years come December. 12 of that I spent down in Southern California, and the rest has been up in here.
Thank you.
I personally have been to more law enforcement officers' funerals than I would care to think about. And in fact, I have two very good friends whose names are inscribed on the memorial down in California for peace officers murdered in the line of duty. This Medal of Honor is not so much for the officers themselves, but is for their families. And I've spent a lot of time with surviving family members. I've seen the grief that they go through in the grieving process. This would just be a simple recognition by the state that their loved one who gave their life in the line of duty for the protection of all citizens didn't die in vain, and the state is acknowledging the death they suffered and the sacrifice they made. As I said, this bill is more for the families than it is for the officers themselves, although it would create a good morale boost for the law enforcement community. It's more importantly, it's the type of thing, it's the small little things that the survivors most remember when they're going through this trauma and this tragedy. And this would be just one more symbolism from the state in recognition of the sacrifice that their loved ones made, and I urge you to pass this bill on to the full Senate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Chief.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this very important piece of legislation. I know your
agenda... Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I know your agenda is full, and I'll be very brief. My name is Ken Johnson. I'm the police chief for the city of Fairview. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and I also serve on the Washington State Law Enforcement Medal of Honor for the Governor's Committee. I've had personal experience and involvement with Washington's Law Enforcement Medal of Honor program and have seen the meaning that this brings to the families, primarily of the survivors. I remember when the governor bent down and placed the Medal of Honor around a little four-year-old's neck whose dad had been killed in the line of duty. And that young man, with tears in his eyes, had the brightest, biggest smile I can remember, and he tapped that medal on his chest, and he said, "This is for my dad." We would greatly appreciate your support for HB 2977. It's very important to the families and of the surviving members that have given their life in the line of duty. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee?
Just one, Madam Chair.
Please, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I appreciate you being here. And I really like this bill. I'm surprised we didn't think of this when we did the Fallen Officers Memorial Fund. That seems like it would have been an appropriate thing to do at that time. But let me clarify with both of you. This appears to set up a governor's commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor that will meet every 6 months and decide who is to get one of these medals. Is that correct?
Would make recommendations to the governor.
Okay, and then the governor makes the final decision?
Yes.
Okay. And then the state is not going to put up any money to purchase the medals because I guess we don't have any money, or we're just finding another way to do it. Help me out here, guys.
There are provisions in the bill for privately funding the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor, which we also had to do in the state of Washington to get the bill during the first initial years.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, there is no money coming from the state at all. It seems like we could kick in a little bit somewhere. But I guess we're doing the commission, and they're not being paid from what I can tell. So.
That is correct.
All right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that you came forward.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. There's no one else signed up for this. Would anybody else like to speak on this? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2977 and open a work session on House Bill 2977. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2977 to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2977 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
I'd be delighted to, Madam Chair. I think that
thank
was
you
a great
very
time.
Much. And thank you for coming. Okay, now we will open a work session on. Oh, actually, before we do that, Senator Beyer, I'd like to call on you.
Madam Chair, I think we have to open the work session first, I believe. Before
I don't think so. I think we have to move to suspend the rules first.
I move the rule be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2416A.
Senator Beyer has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2416A. Would you explain your motion?
Madam Chair, the bill needs conflict amendments as it is in conflict with House Bill 2291.
Okay, thank you. Those are the opinion that is there any objection to suspending the rules? So ordered. The rules have been suspended. And now we will open a work session on House Bill 2416. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we pass House Bill 2416 with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2416 was sent to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The vote has been reconsidered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendments to resolve conflicts be moved into House Bill 2416A.
Senator Beyer has moved the A2 amendments to resolve conflicts to House Bill 2416. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2416A to the floor of the do-pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2416 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Objection. So ordered. Senator Ringo will carry this bill. Thank you for going through that drill. Okay, now we will open a work session at this time on Senate Bill 1047. I think, if that's, is that yours? Okay, please proceed.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 1047 comes to you from the Rules Committee. We had a...
Gotcha. Did you do? He clipped him.
So the record reflect that the council was not injured by the binder clip that came my way.
Bob, you need to know, is that harassment? Were you offensively offended on that?
What's that?
Harassment?
Yeah. Offensive.
You've got lots of lawyers in the room who can handle this for you, council.
This measure was had a public hearing yesterday, and we carried it over to today because there was a -1 amendment that, while not extremely extensive, it was difficult to read the -1 together with the original bill, so we had a hand-engrossed version distributed to the members that should be before you now. This is the bill that would give statutory authority for local public safety coordinating councils to convene domestic violence fatality review teams in each county. It is a discretionary decision. The local LPSCs may choose, in each of the counties, may choose to convene such a team. They may choose not to. If they do convene such a team, as it would be amended by the -1, the team, the statute would prescribe the membership of the team, that the two-thirds vote would be required for the team to release any recommendations, and it would provide that the documents provided to the team are confidential, that the team's meetings are not subject to public meetings rules, and that uh, and finally, that any documents provided to the team would not necessarily be exempt from discovery merely because they were provided to the team itself.
Okay, thank you. We have the dash one amendments in front of us, and we are in work session. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1047.
Senator Walker has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1047. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The intent of this bill, I agree with. The issue with the dash one amendments, I have concerns in subsection 10 of section 2, where the dash one amendments change a majority of the members of the team to issue a recommendation to a two-thirds members of the team of the members of the teams. This sets up in statute a barrier so that a minority of members of the team can block information and recommendations, and I don't think that's appropriate. I've never seen this in any other task force work groups, other teams that we set up to try to gather information and make recommendations, whether it be to the legislature or to other bodies, as this team, these teams do. I can't support that. In fact, I'd like to amend this amendment in order to take it back to a simple majority. And I think, you know, we all recognize the two-thirds bar is that's a bar beyond raising taxes in the state. That's a bar that raises to a veto override and to a constitutional revision. The only other areas that we have that kind of requirement in our law for the legislature. And this is talking about a multidisciplinary team making recommendations to a body. So I can't support that. You know, I think of a local area. I think it would be better if the statute was silent and let the local people, if they're going to work a consensus, I think that's fine if the statute is silent and the local people want to work that way. I've been on teams that have done that before. They said, well, let's agree to work on consensus on this issue. That way we have a stronger recommendation and they have to work together better. But this is a bar that I don't, a case has been made for creating this bar in my mind.
Okay, and I think you raise a very legitimate point. I'd actually like to invite Ms. Hebb up to talk about this a little bit on the record. And Mr. Berry's here from the DA's. I don't know if that is something, if this is something you've worked on and would feel comfortable or you just want to rely on.
We have Senator, and Sybil was just explaining that to you, that I'm not personally familiar with those discussions.
Okay, so we'll just go with Ms. Hebb. Could you elaborate on the issues that Senator Beyer raised?
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, for the record. And the particular change that Senator Beyer is referring to is in subsection 10 of Section 2 of the bill, and it has to do with the recommendations that a team will make and when those recommendations may be released and forwarded for dissemination and implementation in the community. And the recommendations are recommendations about how the local community could have responded better to prevent the death. And the original bill had language that required that the recommendations could be released upon the approval of the majority of the team. That language was changed to say, to indicate that recommendations could be released upon the approval of two-thirds of the team. That was a suggestion that was raised by the District Attorney's Association, but it was an issue that we had, frankly, I think, not given enough consideration to. We, and by we I mean the Law Center, the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic Violence, Judge Kosh, the Multnomah County Family Violence Steering Committee, and Judge Kosh is from Multnomah County, as you know, and the other people who had been working on this bill for a long period of time came to the agreement that two-thirds was an appropriate sort of number to require that sort of a support before a recommendation can be made. And the reason that we made the agreement, I think, is that upon reflection, frankly, I think the point of the review in the first place is to help local communities respond more appropriately. But these reviews and these recommendations are not mandated, and they don't have the force of law. They depend in great part on the sort of the buy-in and the belief that the review team has in the ability of the recommendations to be effective. And so we felt that it was not inappropriate to have a larger portion of the team believe in and be behind the recommendations, because those team members would have a great deal to do with implementing the recommendations and moving forward with them. So that was sort of the discussion behind that change. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions that the committee might have.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Senator Pruzanski.
Two-thirds versus three-fifths are something greater. Is there any other reason why that number is selected, just knowing that the threshold is that much greater?
No, actually, Senator Pruzanski, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I think actually, and maybe I misspoke earlier, the initial suggestion was that we have three-fourths approval, and we were concerned that that may be too great a number, that there may be some members who couldn't be convinced, or maybe who had personal interests in how the recommendations were played out, and so we thought that two-thirds was an appropriate compromise, but there is a certain arbitrariness to the amount that we chose. To speak to one of the concerns that Senator Beyer raised, I do believe that there is value in having the statute set the bar, whatever that bar may be, because I think that there would be concern about having a local team decide to operate only on consensus. That seems to me to be inappropriate, and it might take away from the effectiveness of the bill if a team were able to make that decision that everybody had to buy in. There will be some agencies who and some professionals involved in the review who may have their own interests at stake, and it would be unfortunate if that were something that could derail the process. So that was.
Thank you very much. Other discussion? Committee, I think this bill is far more important than the number, if any, of the threshold in this regard. So I think what I'd like to do is just pass it on in its current form today and invite the discussion to continue in the House as to what this threshold would be. I don't think it's a ditch to die in either way when it comes to this bill. So I think we will go ahead and do that and move it along its way. So is there any other discussion on the -1 amendment? Okay. Any objection?
Yes.
Senator Beyer objects. Senator Whitsitt objects. Would you call the roll? Thank you.
Calling the roll on the amendment? Or
amendment.
Okay.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pruzanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
4 ayes, 2 nays.
Okay, Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1047 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 1047 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Come vote no.
Objection? Okay, let's go ahead and call the roll again.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pruzanski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
5 ayes, 1 nay.
Thank you. Senate Bill 1047 is approved, and I will carry it. We will now open. What do you recommend next, Council? Should we do this? 2360. Okay, we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2360. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2360 would impose a fine and mandatory jail sentence for persons convicted of misdemeanor driving under the influence of intoxicants if the person had 0.20% or more of a blood alcohol content at the time of the offense. As a the first time offender, the first conviction, would require a 7-day jail sentence. I would note, however, that probably 95% of those first time offenders will have already gone through a diversion program. And then the second or greater offense within a 5-year period of time would require a jail sentence of 60 days. The bill expressly states that that jail time can be served in local jail minimum security facilities, which would be similar to a work release type program, or inpatient rehabilitation or treatment centers.
Thank you very much. We have signed up the Bradbury and others, perhaps from the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I'll let you figure out who to bring up, Mr. Berry.
Katie's waving us on.
Okay. Yeah, just get rid of it. Welcome.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I'm immediate past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I chair the legislative committee for this legislative session. With me is Gina Skinner, who is the deputy district attorney in Washington County. And this particular bill, House Bill 2360, is an ODAA-sponsored bill which would increase mandatory minimum penalties for individuals convicted of driving under the influence and having a blood alcohol content in excess of 0.20. I didn't really prepare testimony, but I would like to give you some points that we went through as we were discussing this particular issue through the association. We recognize, and I think everyone in this room probably recognizes, that the issue of driving under the influence of intoxicants is one that creates a community safety risk at almost any level. Almost any level of alcohol consumption and driving creates an increased risk of accidents, creates an increased risk of danger to members of our community. We currently have a mandatory level, 0.08, that I think everybody is familiar with, and in fact we get routinely in my office and offices around the state, we have individuals arrested and convicted of driving under the influence with blood alcohol levels of 0.08, 0.09, 0.10, levels that are at the legal limit or relatively slightly above. Unfortunately, we all too often have individuals who are arrested and submit blood alcohol through the intoxilizer, give us blood alcohol results that exceed 0.20. I will tell you, within the last 3 months, we've had an individual who submitted a blood alcohol level at almost a 0.40 level, which many would tell you should be comatose.
Yeah.
It should be. That's correct, Senator Burdick. We have individuals not uncommonly submitting blood alcohol results in excess of 0.3, and as we go down the level, even more often of 0.20, 0.22, 0.25, 0.28. These individuals not only create the risk that drunk drivers create on our highways, but the risk, I would suggest to you, increases substantially. Currently, I suppose you could argue that the penalty for blowing a 0.09 is exactly the same as someone who continues to drink to the point of being falling down drunk, to the, when we talk about drunk driver, the person that we often think about or that our jurors think about, to a person who is barely capable of getting the key into the lock but decides to drive their automobile. These individuals, I would submit to you, are much more likely to change what we might see as the weaving vehicle down the road to the vehicle that's in the ditch, to the vehicle that we observe doing poor driving, crossing the center line, crossing the fog line, to someone who now is going the wrong way down I-5, to individuals who are far more likely to be involved in crashes with other vehicles, with pedestrians, with bicycle riders, and with passengers in their vehicle than those who are at a lower level, although still dangerous to drive. I would be, I think, remiss if I didn't, at least for the record, state that drinking and driving is a bad idea at any level. but the levels that we're discussing here are so high and create such an increased substantial risk of injury or death to members of our community that, in fact, we ought to take a statement as a state, as a community, to say that you will be, at the least, subject to an enhanced penalty for drinking to those types of levels and deciding to operate a motor vehicle. I'd be happy to answer questions or turn over to Gina.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Gina Skinner from Washington County District Attorney's Office. I am currently the coordinator of the misdemeanor unit, which is primarily consists of prosecuting DUI cases and domestic violence cases. So I see hundreds, literally, of these cases going through our office on a monthly basis. One of the only comments I wanted to add to what Mr. Berry's already said to you is people that are, like you commented or you made the official expression when we said there was a .40 or a .30, these are not uncommon BACs or blood alcohol contents that we see in our office, but these people are functioning. They're driving, they're walking, they're talking. Most of these people consume alcohol on a very regular basis in an effort to be able to drive a car at this high level of alcohol content, which means it's more likely that they're driving at this kind of an alcohol content or some level of alcohol content on a regular basis and just have not been caught. Just because some person has been convicted maybe once before or maybe hasn't been convicted at all, they may be driving around impaired on a regular basis because they are have an alcohol problem, which one would most likely have to be able to function at this high level of alcohol. As a result, that they need to have more of a punishment. There needs to be more of a deterrence that after they get caught, if they don't serve any time in jail at all the first time, there's very little deterrence for them to not continue this behavior without some higher level of punishment to look back at the past behavior and look forward to the future behavior and the level of risk that we're looking at as far as the danger to the community. Thank you.
How many of the, just from your experience, how common is it for a person with these super levels of alcohol to be brought in on a first offense?
Chair Burdick, what's difficult to assess, and it's as I was just commenting, is when you say first offense, we're looking at the first time that somebody that's driving impaired has been caught.
I understand.
As far as somebody for the first time they've been caught, it's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I it would be very difficult for me to throw out a number, but I would say I don't see, and I see hundreds of these cases go through. I'm in charge of touching these cases that go through our office every single day, and I don't see really a correlation between the blood alcohol content and how many DUIs that you have. But for the fact, when you see somebody that has 4, 5, 6, 7 DUIs, they're always going to be very high. But other than that, I see first time, I don't see a correlation necessarily with like a first time offense is always an 08 or an 09 or 10. We don't see that. It's just as likely to see a high BAC in the first offense as it is the third offense.
How much do you have to drink to get to .20?
Yeah, Mr. Ross is here, Chair.
Mr. Ross can come forward.
That's okay. He signed up. We can. I don't want to take away from your testimony, Mr. Ross. You were actually signed up first here.
That's fine.
We can share.
If I'd known who you were, I would have called you up with that.
Sure. Senator Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Rost. I'm a forensic supervisor with the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. And just as a little bit of background, my responsibilities within the Forensic Services Division include the oversight of the breath alcohol testing program for the Department of State Police, as well as the toxicology services within the Portland Forensic Laboratory. So any of the samples that are blood, breath, or urine that are being analyzed for purposes of driving under the influence cases are going to be coming through either the Portland Forensic Laboratory or the Springfield Forensic Laboratory, so I'll be touching them somehow. But I answered your question about how much alcohol it would take to get somebody to a .20. Yes, I do. Just a second here. There you go. Thank you, Tom. For the average 175-pound male, if I can kind of ballpark it, it is going to depend upon gender, It generally is that females will require less alcohol to accomplish the same blood alcohol concentration pound for pound versus a male. But for a 175-pound male, we're talking somewhere in the order of 7 to 8 drinks within a one-hour period to get to a .20. So now if it's going to take...
I have to respond to that.
It's going to take additional alcohol. It's going to take additional alcohol in order to maintain that level. If there's any additional amount of time under which the person is drinking, so if they're drinking in a social setting for 2, 2.5, 3 hours, you're going to need to add alcohol to that equation in order to maintain that .20 blood alcohol concentration. So we're not talking about, I guess I kind of hesitate maybe to use this term, but I don't know that we're talking about the recreational drinker.
It's not a couple of glasses of wine at dinner.
Right.
Yeah. Senator Pozanski, did you want to respond? This should be really good.
I have to put a preface here. When I was in the district attorney's office, one of the things we did was actually succumb to being testees for the DOE alcohol awareness programs that were used for different departments. And, of course, they had the people that were driving to the event and stuff like that. I had 9 Coors Lights in an hour, and I was at a 1-3. And there's no doubt that I should not be driving. But I'm kind of surprised with that number that you come up with only 7 or 8 in an hour's time, just because it seems to me that it would be a little bit higher. And I do have another question, Madam Chair, after that.
Yeah, well, I've never met anybody who had 9 Coors Lights in 1 hour.
That is terrible. That should have been a law.
It's an impressive number, Senator.
That should have been a law against it. So, but it was a good call.
I hope someone else was driving.
Oh, it was. It was a good training. It was a MAP program that actually they worked with the state, with the different departments that had officers that were coming onto the department looking for being able to make these field observations and field sobriety tests, and that's really what it was for. And so there are a number of us from the district attorney's office as well as other county offices that were willing to succumb to that.
Chair Burdick, if I might, members of the committee, most of us in DA's offices have had the opportunity to participate in those exercises like Senator Pozanski, as well as it's not been uncommon for Mr. Ross to bring an intoxilizer to our social functions for the DA's association. One, it educates us on how the machines are used, and it's the only time that candidly anybody is around alcohol at all with it, unless they're involved in that. And I can tell you from watching others that you'd say, you can tell they've obviously been drinking, they're clearly under the influence. Rarely are they blowing over a 1.0, and often not up to an 0.8. And I think Jeff could testify to that, that it's really quite interesting. And then we get the other end where we're now in court and seeing these very high levels of blood alcohol content, and really people who are performing field tests better than I would be able to at half their blow or even less. So it's really quite disconcerting to watch the types of numbers we see.
Senator Burdick and members of the committee, if I could add just a little bit to Mr. Berry's comments. Just to give you an idea, we're based upon data that's collected by the law enforcement data system, as well as data that is downloaded from the actual breath testing instruments that we use in the state, we're talking about the top 13% of breath tests and blood tests that are conducted in the state. And so that just to give you an idea of the overall numbers, we do on the average about 20 to 25,000 DUI arrests in the state of Oregon per year. And so we're talking about the top 13% of those cases that are in that range of being 2.0 or above. So we're in the 3,000, 3,500 cases per year that we're talking about. That's really what this bill will target.
Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I do have, because in my practice as a prosecutor, the ones I see that seem to be blowing on those higher levels, and I want to say anywhere from basically probably 1.6, 1.7 on up, are probably alcoholics. I mean, the vast majority of people, I've had a couple that come to mind which should have been comatose, 3.1, 3.4, and you're just kind of wondering how do these people, and I think about my experience of doing through this class, how anyone can even function. So could you give us a little bit of information as to your studies as to, I mean, it seems to me that we're really talking about the person who is a more of a long-term problem drinker as compared to someone that is a binge type of drinker. When I say binge in the sense of a social person, college age or whatever it might be, that ties one on for, you know, for really ties one on. As because it just seems to me that we are talking about people who in our society probably are functioning in their daily life under the influence as we have defined it. And that's who it seems like we're going to be really focusing on and who's going to be picked up in this thing.
Chair Burdick and Senator Przanski, I'd love to tell you that it's really clear-cut in that way, but it's not. But certainly I can say that that's the intent of the targeting of this bill is on those people that are, you know, extremely in excess in terms of use. Unfortunately, with the wide variety of alcoholic content of beverages that are available today, certainly 7 or 8 beers within an hour is a lot of alcohol, but 7 or 8 shots of whiskey or a mixed drink like a Long Island iced tea or 2 or 3 of those in an hour isn't necessarily unattainable. And so depending upon the context or the drinking environment that you're in, some of those higher blood alcohol concentrations are not that far out of being attainable. Just, you know, again, I'll throw out another number, but the average blood alcohol concentration for DUI arrests in the state is a 0.15. And so we aren't, you know, between 0.5 and 0.15 and 0.20, you know, there's not a lot of room in there necessarily, but we're making up a lot of ground in terms of the overall percentage of DUI arrests between those two values to get from, you know, what would otherwise be 50 or 51% of the arrests to suddenly being 13% when we get to the 0.20 level. And so that other, you know, 30 or so percent is sitting in between those two values. And so I'm not sure that it's necessarily that clear cut with respect to drinking pattern. I think what is maybe clear cut is performance in terms of driving ability. Certainly those people that are routinely obtaining higher blood alcohol concentrations are going to be more tolerant drinkers. They're going to be more routinely at those levels and probably more routinely operating motor vehicles at those levels because they're more accustomed to operating at that level. The brain is a wonderful thing. It adapts magnificently to adverse conditions when routinely exposed to those adverse conditions. And so, again, it's very appropriate that this bill would be targeting those people that are routinely putting those kinds of hazards on our roadways.
And Chair Burdick, Senator Przanski, also adding to that question, when you're looking at the kind of alcohol we're talking about, it's just a matter of physics, but it's a lot easier to drink 7 or 8 or 9 shots of hard alcohol versus 7, 8, or 9 beers. Most people can't, especially if you've had anything to eat, it would almost be impossible to drink that much liquid and be remotely comfortable. And so if you look at the kind of alcohol that most people drink when they are out tying one on, as you put it, it's more commonly beer, that kind of an alcohol versus drinking straight shots of liquor, which is almost what is required to get to some of these higher levels of alcohol, which if you are a problem drinker, as you had previously mentioned, or alcoholic, you're going to skip all the fillers and you're just going straight to the hard alcohol. And that's what we find oftentimes in these cases. We'll see empty bottles or almost empty bottles of you know, hard liquor that is in the car on the floorboard. And so those are more likely going to be with the problem drinkers that are just focusing on being impaired.
And
then Ringo.
Thank you. The bill requires that people shall serve jail time. Is there capacity in our jails? Do we have space?
I expected that question, and I know actually Mr. Ross is going to have some comments about some potential cost to OSP, so Chair Burdick and Senator Ringo, if I might address some of those, all of those issues perhaps at once. One, I think it depends in part on the county. All counties have some jail. I'm fortunate in Yamhill County that we don't have a jail space problem, but I'm certainly not ignorant of the fact that many of the counties do have jail space problems. However, I would suggest that when we're dealing with individuals with alcohol levels of 0.20 or above and driving automobiles, that as the jails and the communities look to establish their matrix for who goes in and does how much time and who comes out when the inn is full, so to speak, I would suggest that those people probably pose more of a risk than the person who is dropped for 5 or 6 days for a dirty UA while on probation.
Well, just hang on a second, Madam Chair. So what kind of people do you think we'd be letting out?
If now we're putting more people in jail, who's likely to walk because of this?
In my county, which I can only talk about that, that's the only place that I've been involved in those discussions. We would be routinely, rather than someone doing a 10-day sanction for a probation violation, that the probation officer dropped them, they likely now would be doing five. And we would be having a person doing the 7 days on a DUI at a .20 or higher. You also have to remember that this only moves the mandatory minimum from to 7 days from 48 hours for judges who have been imposing the jail time, which is already mandatory minimum, or 80 hours of community service. And there is a cost to, in fact, supervising community service. The other cost, if I might go there, I think Mr. Ross is going to talk about the potential they see of more individuals being called from his unit to have to testify to a person's blood alcohol level at a .20 at the time they were driving. And not to preempt Mr. Ross, but as we were talking, they're estimating an FTE cost potential on this.
Madam Chair? Excuse me. My concern is that the people we're putting in jail, that we'd be putting in jail because of this, certainly pose a hazard to the public. I mean, there's no arguing about that. I think they need treatment. I mean, I think you said that. These are people that have severe alcohol problems. So we're going to put them in jail, especially if it's a second offense. It's for a somewhat lengthy period. And we're letting, because we don't have space, we'll be letting people out who may have been busted for stealing cars several times or breaking and entering or assault and these other crimes. And so to me, we're making a choice between locking people up that, yes, are dangerous, but they need treatment. So our treatment is going to be to lock them up while other people that have committed offenses that I think truly deserve punishment, it's not a matter of treatment, but it's a matter of they're breaking society's rules and they need to stay in jail, we're going to be letting them out of jail.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, I would suggest a couple of things. One, some of the people that I talked about, those who are doing sanctions, didn't show up to report to their probation officer when they were supposed to. The people that you're talking about who steal cars, who are sentenced up front, most of those people are placed on probation, will do a short period of jail time locally anyway, but rarely do those individuals who are stealing the car or doing a car clout and stealing my stereo, for example, things like that that are picking up local jail time, rarely, I would suggest, do they pose the imminent threat to you and I on the roads that individuals driving over a .20 do.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that. But still, we're taking people that need treatment, putting them in jail, taking people that need to be punished and pulling them out of jail. Manager, just to follow up on another point, we've heard a number of bills, and I can't keep track this session, on relating to DUIs. And we heard some last session. And I don't think we should tolerate DUI, but I don't know at what point we say, okay, now the laws are appropriate. I mean, we're constantly make it more difficult to get diversion in one context or up the penalty in this instance and up the penalty for that instance. At what point are we going to say the laws are what they are, and it's just not going to help? There's not going to be any further deterrence, and we're going to be satisfied with the way they are.
Chair Burke, Senator Ringo, I don't know if we will ever know when we get to that point. We're always looking at what has happened over the last 2 years and trying to make improvements. I think that one of the concerns that we had about this was when you look at DUI prosecution, now we have made the fourth DUI conviction a felony. And so we're looking at four times, and it's a felony. The mandatory minimum on that, assuming you have no other property felonies, is 13 to 14 months in prison. And so one of the messages we're trying to send is that there's some graduation to get to that point.
And I entirely agree with that.
So that they're not getting a couple of days in jail, and the next thing they know, they turn around the corner, and they're going to prison.
Right.
And so that they get some idea of where this is headed. In addition to that, there was a significant amount of inconsistency among the counties. We try to stress in Washington County of that graduation, so that when you're looking at the second or third time, that there's some sort of a percentage of that 13 to 14 months that you're going to serve before you get to that level, but that every county was treating these so differently, that they were maybe getting just the 48 hours, and the second time they still only get 48 hours, and the third time they still only get 48 hours, and that they're not getting that difference.
I completely agree that the repeat offenders deserve harsher and harsher punishment. And the ones that habitually reoffend, they're habitually posing a risk to society, and we need to remove that risk. This bill deals with first-time offenders.
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, this bill deals with, in actuality, probably 95% of the time dealing with second and third offenders.
Well, this because is the first time we've got them, though.
Well, but the first one, they've already done diversion.
All right.
And so then the second time now, we're looking at the 7 days if they have a higher BAC, because then they're assuming that the first time they already were required to do treatment. I mean, that's what diversion is all about. And they've most likely successfully completed that diversion, and that case has been dismissed. And now we're looking at this second time offense, where instead of doing 48 hours in jail, we're only upping that 5 days to seven. And really, a lot of that time is just drying out period so that they can sit back and think about what they really need to do in order to start their treatment process. And then we're talking for the 60-day offender. That's the third time that we're looking at this person. And now we're always going to be concerned about trying to rehabilitate and trying to provide treatment options, and that will be part of their probation when as soon as they get out of jail. But in the meantime, our first priority now, we get to number three, is the safety of the community.
Madam Chair, why not leave some judicial discretion, though?
Chair Burke, Senator Ringo, I think what Ms. Skinner mentioned about inconsistency throughout the state is part of it. There are judges who literally, until we hit a minimum, until they're said, for example, it's a felony and you're going to send someone to prison, they aren't imposing jail sentences. This bill sends, I think, a message from us to those who choose to drive with such high levels of alcohol that this is more serious.
Maybe that judge knows that the jail is full, and they know, I'm going to have to convict, and now I know this guy's going to walk. And doesn't it make sense to trust our judges?
Chair Burdick and Senator Ringer, in my county, again, I can only speak locally, our judges are part of the discussions about establishing who's released from the jails and establishing the matrix. So my point that I try to make early, I may not have done it very well, is that when we're dealing with individuals who will pick up this 7-day minimum on a .20 or higher conviction, again, they've already had a diversion, which I hadn't mentioned earlier, and I'm glad Ms. Skinner did, we recognize they're a greater danger than other people we might be holding.
Madam Chair, just a follow. I'll quit talking, but I just expressing my reluctance to bill after bill after bill relating to DUIs. I'm tempted to ask, what are we going to see next session? It's a significant problem. There's no doubt it's a significant problem. Continually increasing the penalties, I'm not convinced that's the answer.
Thank you. Council?
One thing, Senator Ringo, that I did want to point out that this bill does do, this was a concern of some of the House Judiciary Committee members. They then, the second time we kind of went through the bill, noticed that and this would affect the 60-day sentences in particular. There is a provision in this bill to do day-for-day credit at a work release center or at an inpatient treatment or rehabilitation center.
Yeah.
And that did change the mind of some of your colleagues on the House side. I don't know if it makes a difference for you, but I did want to point it out to you.
No, I think that's a good feature.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, thank you. And I apologize to the panel if you've covered this while I was out of the room, but there's two questions. The first, what sanction is applied to the detainee when they refuse a breath or blood test?
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsitt, those tend to come up front. One, if a person refuses the breath test at the time that they're arrested, there is an increased penalty for increased license suspension because of the refusal. Also passed last session was a bill which set a mandatory fine, I think of $1,000.
$500.
Until I don't do these every day. $500 for refusing the breath test. That's like another traffic violation that goes.
I understand that, sir, but this is as a $2,500 fine, so why on earth would you take a breath test if there's any chance that you might blow a .2? Because it would be a $2,500 fine and 7 days in jail as opposed to a suspension of your license and a $500 fine.
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsitt, I would suggest that it is unlikely most of these individuals would ever believe they're over a .20, and in fact many of them, as amazing as it may seem, think that they're perfectly fine to drive, let alone that they'll blow that high of a level.
Second question, Madam Chair, please. 160-pound male would require about how much alcohol to reach a 0.20 blood alcohol content within, say, consuming it within 2 hours? Like how many beers, how many ounces of wine, how many ounces of 80-proof spirit?
7 or 8, Senator Whitsitt.
Hmm?
7 or 8.
That's for 175
pounds.
But
we're in that ballpark, actually. 7 or 8 is probably a good. It's going to depend on gender. It's going to depend on weight. Senator, what's it? It's going to depend on several different individual factors. But generally, if I were to give you a ballpark figure, it'd be 7 to 8, possibly as many as 9, given that you have a 2-hour drinking period involved there. Beverages and I guess to define a drink, I would define a drink as a 12-ounce beer, can of beer, generally in the 4 to 5% range. That would be equivalent to a 5-ounce glass of table wine at 12%, or a 1.5-ounce shot of a hard alcohol like gin or whiskey or tequila or something of that nature. So we're talking 7 or 8 shots.
You missed Senator Pazansky's comment that in the name of science, he actually consumed 9 Coors Lights to get to 0.13, and I can tell you he does not weigh 175 pounds.
That's right.
He bikes too much for that.
All right. Well, I apologize for being out of the room during that discussion.
Oh, that's fine.
It's on tape. You can always follow us.
Yeah. We intend to use that against him frequently in the future. Okay. Mr. Ross, you kind of got chopped up a little bit here. Are there any other points you want to make?
Yes, please. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, again, I'm here on behalf of the Forensic Services Division, and I would like to say that the Forensics Division is certainly in support of this type of legislation, but we do feel that it's necessary to recognize that it will come with some potential fiscal impacts to the Forensic Services Division, and the Forensics Division has chosen in this case to attach a fiscal impact to this bill. If I could just for a minute beg the committee's indulgence and talk just briefly about a kind of a frequently overlooked disconnect that exists between Oregon's implied consent statutes and Oregon's driving under the influence statutes. Most of the forensic analyses that we're talking about for blood, breath, and urine are samples that are actually taken for analysis subject to Oregon's implied consent statutes. And those statutes basically jeopardize or hold hostage an offender's privileges to possess a license in exchange for submitting to the provision of a sample. And so if a person refuses to submit to a sample, as Senator Whitsitt referred to, that's an increased suspension of a driver's license. And that is generally referred to as an administrative suspension, that's not a criminal penalty, but rather an administrative suspension of the individual's driving privileges. There is no statement made within the implied consent statutes with respect to when that sample is taken in relation to the conduct that rose to the offense. And so the test result that is measured actually is that, or the decision as to whether or not a suspension is going to occur is based upon the result of the test at the time the test is taken. There's no calculation back to what the individual was at the time of driving. And that's where the disconnect is under Oregon's DUI statutes, or driving under the influence statutes, it's actually part of the prosecution's case or the burden to show that at the time of driving, the subject actually had a prohibited blood alcohol concentration. And so if there's any sort of delay between the time of the offense and the time of the test or the time that the sample is provided, and subsequently any type of delay could have possibly resulted in any change in blood alcohol concentration over that period of time, those are the cases that forensic analysts, forensic personnel are going to be called in to testify in those cases to talk about what potential change in blood alcohol concentration may have occurred over that time.
Generally speaking, when we get called in now, we're talking about cases that are very near the presumptive level of 0.08, the prohibited level of 0.08. These are the 0.07, 0.08, 0.09, 0.10 cases that we're being called in to talk about whether or not the 45 minutes, hour, hour and a half, 2 hour delay that occurred could have resulted in a change in the person's blood alcohol concentration. Could they have been under 0.08 at the time of driving and over at the time of the test? Or if they were over, what were they at the time of driving, over or under the legal limit? Our concern within the Forensic Services Division is that by creating a second prohibited blood alcohol concentration level at the 0.20 level, you potentially could be bringing additional contested cases into the criminal court system that potentially could result in additional subpoenas arriving on the doorstep of the forensic laboratories to come in and talk about 1-9, 2-0, 2-1, 2-2 cases that could be looking at potential enhancement. For that reason, not being, aware of the fact that we were talking about, the top 13% of the cases, aware of the fact that we really can't ask for anything less than one FTE, we did set the fiscal impact at one FTE, knowing that probably some percentage of that was going to be tied up with these additional cases and having to testify in those additional cases. Additionally, it probably should be pointed out that the second offender, third time offender cases are likely going to be contested cases anyway, because the offender in that case is likely interested in trying to minimize any possibility of them being labeled as a repeat offender, particularly when they're looking at enhanced felony status, enhanced fines, enhanced prison terms. There's a good chance that those cases are going to be contested anyway. And so, again, that's going to increase the likelihood that somebody from the Forensics Division would be called in. And so... Again, without making it sound in any way that we are opposed to this legislation, we certainly wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee that there's likely going to be some additional impact to the Forensic Services Division with the reality of reduced staffing and the fact that we're triaging cases already within the Forensic Services Division. We would be remiss in not bringing that to the committee's attention. So thank you, Kyle.
Thank you. Question, Senator Walker.
Hey, Madam Chair. Been waiting to get my word in edgewise here this afternoon, but the very first question you have circled in a square box is, where's the fiscal? Mm-hmm. This bill has no fiscal statement in it, and clearly we have testimony that there is a fiscal impact.
Right. Do we have one already, Councilor?
Yes. Senator Walker and Senator Burdick, we did, when this came out of the House, we did receive the fiscal analysis. It was determined by legislative fiscal to be indeterminate. I'd be happy to sort of go into detail or just make sure that you're all provided copies.
I think we've heard enough detail. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
And we would like copies. Yes, Senator?
Yeah, I'd like a copy, but I mean, I guess... Someone here should be able to tell us what one FTE in a forensics lab costs and how can it be indeterminate.
Well, Senator Byer and members of the committee, the reason it's indeterminate is, among other things, it was assumed that there would be 6,900 of these types of offenses per biennium. So assuming that 100% of them were fined, the minimum $2,500, then the revenue impact would have been $17.3 million. Obviously it's rare for a criminal defendant to pay their fine, particularly right in the upfront beginning of their sentence. The Oregon Judicial Department anticipated an increase in court operation costs because of the potential increased trials. The Public Defense Services Commission anticipated the measure to have a minimal fiscal impact related to indigent defense. The state police estimated the one FTE position, and so for the biennium, it was $125,000 for the 2005 to 2007 biennium and $157,000 for the next biennium. Department of Corrections and Department of Transportation said no fiscal, and then, of course, there was the concern about local jail costs as well. So I believe the indeterminate number comes from, among other things, balancing out the potential revenue with the costs, as well as the other agencies reporting minimum fiscal but not exact numbers.
And Chair Burdick, I just want to briefly comment as far as the court costs. Again, seeing so many of these cases, people that have a blood alcohol content of this level very rarely go to trial. These cases are ones where they know they're guilty, in the sense that they know that the numbers are going to convict them. And so it's extremely rare that we ever see anything at this high of a level that gets set for a criminal trial.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, if I might also, if you note from Mr. Ross talking about currently when they come in or when you have those intoxilizer results that are close, the 07s, 08s, 09s, I think you'll find that most prosecutors' offices are going to be charging these and pursuing these enhanced penalties for those who are the 2.3s, 2.4s and above, so that we don't get into the issue of fighting, was it exactly a 2.0 or just over a 2.0 at the time of the driving, which then too would significantly risk the need or desire on either party to have the forensic unit come in and testify. Just like we do now with the ones that are close to the 08s. Typically, you have someone who is has very demonstrative, poor field sobriety tests for us filing an 07, 06, 07, for example, even when we think we could call in the unit to say there were an 08 at the time they were driving.
Okay, thank you. I think we're going to move along with this hearing.
Thank you very much.
Ann Pratt, Bruce Pratt, and Anita Howard. Welcome, and feel free, if you agree with points that were made, that's fine, and if you want to limit your testimony to new points or be very brief, we kind of got a little carried away here. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vanita Howard. My voice is a bit better than it was the last time.
But I'm glad you're on demand.
I couldn't help but think, as I listened to the technical testimony about one of the cases I recall from many years ago, a man who, when breath testing first came in and was arrested for drunk driving over in, I think, around Pendleton or someplace, and he had read about those tests, and he insisted that he be given one because he said, if it comes back less than 0.10, I'm going to quit buying that bootleg stuff. And so he was getting quite familiar with the process very early on. I think the key thing I'd like to mention on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on this bill is that the drivers that are being talked about in this bill are not amateur drinkers. People who drive with a 0.20 or more are among the most worst offenders that we have. And the problem really is not that they drink and drive. The problem is that they drink. Many of them are alcoholics, unrecognized or unwilling to admit it. And they undoubtedly have driven not once, but many times, under the influence and gotten away with it. I think my testimony includes the written testimony about some estimates of how many times they've done this. We believe that they need to have a stronger message sent to them so that they finally maybe will get the message that drinking and driving under the influence, and especially at those high levels, is not something they should do. I have to mention, however, that it's really not enough to simply pass a law that gets tougher when under existing law about $19 million in the fines imposed on drivers convicted of driving under the influence go uncollected. We think the state needs to do a great deal more in trying to make sure that those fines are collected to help pay for the costs that the state encounters in trying to cope with the problem. We see House Bill 2360 as one more tool in the battle against those drivers who abuse alcohol and cost the rest of us millions of dollars in more ways than many of us can even imagine. One example that I came across was an NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration study, done 5 years ago, but concluding alcohol-related crashes by 10% only would save $22 million in claims payments and lost adjustment expenses in Oregon. We all pay for those through our insurance premiums. So we certainly believe that it's time that the most serious drinking driving offenders get a stronger message about their conduct on the highways. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. and Mrs. Pratt.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I'm also testifying on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. My name is Ann Pratt. I am in favor of House Bill. We are in favor of House Bill 2360, and it justly calls for enhanced sanctions for extreme intoxication. DUI offenders who operate a vehicle with more than a .20 or greater are considered high risk, very often repeat offenders and seasoned drinkers. The solution, according to MAD and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is to impose stricter sanctions for those who drink to an extreme degree with no regard to the rest of society. Some of the facts are 9 other states have implemented enhanced sanctions for .20 BAC or above, and 81 other states have enhanced sanctions ranging from 0.15 to 0.20%. Even at 0.15, the following characteristics are present: judgment, self-control, reasoning, memory are impaired. Clear deterioration of reaction time. Muscle coordination becomes poor. Example, balanced speech, vision, reaction time, and hearing with reduced ability to maintain lane position and brake appropriately. Speed and impaired perception, short-term memory loss, and drastic reduction, reduced response are also into play. Other indications are slurred speech, poor coordination, slowed thinking, far less muscle control than normal, vomiting if not accustomed to this level of tolerance as in the seasoned drinker is, and major loss of balance resulting in substantial impairment in vehicle control, attention to driving, necessary visual and auditory information processing. Oregonians are sharing the roadways on a daily basis with these dangerous offenders, and according to law enforcement in Oregon, at least 40% are also impaired on drugs, along with the alcohol. Some other facts are motor vehicle crashes outrank all other diseases and injuries as the major cause of death for children aged 0 to 14, according to the Center for Disease Control. And 64% of children killed by impaired drivers in the U.S. are passengers of their own impaired driver. I have included with my testimony some samples of .20 or above, and I won't go into those. I'll let you read those for yourself. But the question of age was asked, and I did not include the ages of these drunk drivers, but there were 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And some of them I'm sure you will recognize. I tried to include several counties. So please, for public safety's sake, pass House Bill 2360, and also I believe 2361 will be up today. Please pass it as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pratt.
I'm Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Pratt, Crime Victims United, and I'm their DUI subcommittee. I'm here today speaking for all Oregon drivers, passengers, and their loved ones. Any person who insists on driving with a BAC of .20 or more is in complete disregard for the lives of you and I and our fellow citizens, and is beyond having control of a vehicle. My stepson was killed by a drunk driver with a BAC of .19. After the crash, even though this driver was unhurt, he could not stand up and fell against a tree. Testimony at trial showed that this driver was a seasoned drinker, yet his motor skills were in such disarray that walking was not possible. Seasoned drinkers or hardcore drunk drivers are the usual people that are encountered with this high BAC. A hardcore drinking driver, on average, is described as someone who is arrested with a BAC of 0.15 or higher, a person who continually drives after drinking, under 45, white and male, marital status, 46 to 55% are single, 22 to 41% are divorced, high school education or less, and they are often thrill seekers. On weekend nights in the United States, only 1% of drivers have a BAC of 0.15 or higher. The drivers with a 0.15 or higher account for 65% of all drinking driver fatalities. Or to state it another way, a driver with a BAC of greater than 0.15 is 300 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a sober driver. 40% of all fatal crashes include alcohol. But for fatal crashes occurring between midnight and 3 a.m., this number rises to 77% alcohol involvement. Now, this bill has a first offense aspect. We must remember that first-time offender means first-time apprehended. Most experts agree that, on average, a driver cited for DUI has driven impaired an average of 1,000 times before being caught. They also agree that impaired drivers persist in their behavior because these people believe that they will not be caught and or convicted. Another obvious question, why do drivers who have been arrested, convicted, lost their license, and perhaps spent some jail time, continue to drink and drive and kill innocent motorists?
Mr. Pratt, I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize now because we've got a lot of other things we need to get done before 3.
Okay, thank you. Well, it goes on to say that most of these are hardcore drinking drivers and they're practiced. What to remind everyone that treatment is a part of an arrest for drunk driving. So why are we so lenient with intoxicated drivers and any other instance of causing 207 deaths each year would create a huge uproar from society? Now, a person with a BAC of 0.20 is a crash or death or serious injury for waiting for a place to happen. Members of the committee, this bill addresses those people who had not, by the grace of God, killed anyone at the time of their current arrest. We are talking about those people who get totaled, get behind the wheel of their inebriated condition, threaten the lives of law-abiding drivers and their passengers, and this must be stopped. This bill will help. Crime Victims United supports House Bill 2360 and urge forwarding this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Sorry to cut you off there.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
May I make one correction to the written testimony that I submitted? I had a little trouble with the decimal point. The second paragraph of my testimony refers to a 0.8. Should be 0.08.
Yes, exactly. I appreciate you because they'd be twice dead at that level. Thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2360, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2144. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We first heard testimony on May 19th on this bill. This was the bill that would modify conditions of probation for a person previously convicted of a sex offense as an adult or as being adjudicated as a juvenile. If they commit a new crime sometime in the future, this would allow an out-of-state conviction or a juvenile adjudication or a prior conviction for a sex offense to be considered by the individual's probation officer, and the individual's probation officer could request that they do a screening or evaluation and treatment if necessary. There was a concern raised by Mr. Hummel of the OCDLA regarding the juvenile adjudication piece. It seemed to me that some of the committee was also concerned, so I did have a dash one amendment drafted that would remove the juvenile adjudication pieces from this so that the committee could consider the bill one way or the other, and we could just get it moving. I know Ms. Peters is here from Department of Corrections if anyone wants the DOC position, and I see Ms. Sky is here for OCDLA if there needs to be any additional inquiry about the amendment.
Ms. Sky, would you come up? Are you prepared to, and Ms. Peters, Ms. Collette, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, come on up. On the juvenile adjudications, I presume that that was something that you had proposed.
Yeah. Yes, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, we had, there are two components.
Could you identify yourself? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Kelly Sky, a legislative representative for the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And the two components of this bill are, one, to include the out-of-state conviction, so that if somebody's prior sex offense was out-of-state, that they would be treated the same as if it had been in-state, and we did not take a position on that portion of the bill. Our concern was that anybody who had ever had a juvenile adjudication would be included in this, and for many reasons, which I'm sure Mr. Hummel went into at the prior public hearing, we opposed that portion, and so would not take a position on the bill with these amendments.
Okay. I guess my question to you, Collette, and DOC, is whether the bill, you would still support the bill if that was deleted.
Scott Taylor.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections for the Department of Corrections. We've looked at the amendment. We, of course, would prefer the original bill, but we will take any improvement in our ability to consider everyone. So if the committee is prone to move with the amendment, we can work with that, live with that.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Committee, we're down to a reduced number here. I would prefer to move this bill with the amendment. If people have problems with that, we could hold it. But if we could move it with the amendment today, I'd like to do that. So maybe we should just try a motion. Senator Walker? Dash one amendment.
I understand that, Madam Chair. Let me make the motion, then we'll have discussion. I'll make a motion to move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2144.
Senator Walker has moved the dash one amendment to House Bill 2144. Discussion. Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was one who raised some questions at the last hearing, and I had the department come in and have a conversation with me, as well as Sheriff Pat Schreiner. And I asked counsel to get me the materials that were provided to the House committee, and I reviewed them. And I guess I should have told you this, but I actually came to an understanding with myself that I was okay with the bill as it was drafted, because it was made clear to me that we weren't going to be capturing these people who had committed one sex offense as a juvenile when they were 13, 14, or whenever, and then 30 years later they commit another offense, that our sex offender programs are so full right now that they're not going to be targeting these people as being sex offenders that need treatment. So I got comfortable with the bill as drafted, but if you want to go with the dash one, I don't have a problem with that at all. I just want to know that you to know that I did have some conversations with people to try to follow up on my concerns.
Thank you. I appreciate the effort and research you put into this. Is there any other discussion on the dash one amendment? Which note?
You asked about the dash ones earlier.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, well, is there, we can hold on and have more discussion if people have a problem with the dash one. This was brought up during the hearing.
And the dash ones will basically just exclude those that have been convicted or adjudicated as a minor or as a juvenile?
As a juvenile, yes. In the consideration of the previous sex offender records. It would take into account adult previous convictions on sex offense, but not the juvenile adjudications. So,
Madam Chair, one of the reasons that was testified at the hearing and that I got further clarification on is that we do see a pattern with young people if they commit sex offenses and then they become adults and they continue to commit those sex offenses. It would be good to know that there's a pattern established. Also, we don't always get that information from another state. And that's actually the other piece of the bill, which is also very good. But it doesn't happen. I don't think you get the juvenile information from another state without this bill either. Within the jurisdiction.
Well, not with the amendment.
Right.
But you would get the adult.
Adult.
It's a policy issue. I thought the defense lawyers made a legitimate claim, but it's a legitimate policy discussion as to whether you want to include those juvenile.
Yeah, how does the rest of the committee feel about this?
Any other opinions, Senator Beyer?
Well, Madam Chair, that's why I wanted the clarification, because I didn't think you kind of asked the question earlier about it. I prefer the bill as presented without the amendment. I think if we're taking previous convictions, but I would ask counsel a clarifying question. If when a juvenile's record is expunged, would that still be brought forward?
Senator Beyer and members of the committee, I don't believe then that the probation officer would be aware of it, and in any event, the adjudication is not recognized. So, no, I think if the juvenile record is expunged, then it would not be something that the probation officer could consider in the future.
But expungement takes an affirmative effort by the adjudicated juvenile.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Yeah. Senator Pazanski?
But the expungement statute's pretty convoluted as to how you get to where you want to be. I thought sex offenses, almost virtually all of those, are non-expungible. Now, for the juvenile area, I don't do any of that work, so I don't know if juvenile adjudications, if it's as a juvenile as compared to the juvenile being treated as an adult, what difference that would make. But I don't think in expungements, sex offenses are normally expungible.
I think maybe we'll hold off. Before we close this, Senator Brzezinski, did you want to weigh in on the policy matter of the -1 amendment, just so we'll know here?
Yeah, I'm still kind of working through it. I was looking at the bill as it was drafted. I mean, one of the concerns is the portion of having the probation officer require some type of treatment or program that could be so far removed and not have the nexus to whatever their offense or their violation might be, as to requiring, in this case, sex offender program where there's been no indication after 25 years or whatever it might be. So I've been kind of toying with that. This would actually allow for those individuals that were, I guess, adjudicated as juveniles through the juvenile system to not fall within that. And that, I guess, should be somewhat of a measure for, dividing or deciding as to whether, again, if it's 40 years, 30 years down the road, it doesn't seem like there's a nexus mm-hmm. there. But if it's 5 years down the road, there may be a little bit more tie to it.
If I could just clarify, Senator Pazanski, one thing that I would say is it doesn't require the Department of Corrections officer, the probation officer, to send that individual for the screening, evaluation, and treatment. It simply gives them that option. And my understanding from the testimony that I heard both in the Senate Judiciary Committee and as well, I handled this bill on the House side, is what Senator Walker's already alluded to. The resources are so tapped anyway that it would only be, it's not as if a probation officer is going to throw this on a duly 30 years later. This is if the person is presenting with issues and the probation officer has the concern, they want to have that ability to do that, but it is not something that is required by the law that the evaluation has to be ordered if that prior exists.
Senator Walker, would you withdraw your motion, please, for the Dash 1 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would withdraw the motion to approve the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2144.
So ordered. We're going to continue this discussion when we have our other committee members here because I think this is a legitimate policy issue. So we're going to close the work session on House Bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Will you do that? I just wanted to... found something in my file I handed to Senator Whitsitt because I cut it out of the paper this last weekend. It just seems kind of appropriate to bring it up here. Medicaid has been paying for Viagra prescriptions for sex offenders.
Please don't get me started on that, Senator Walker.
for 7 years, Madam Chair, and they paid out over almost $100,000 in the state of Florida for sex offenders to get Viagra. And I just put it in this file and found it, and I thought you all should know about that. Apparently, the president is trying to do some fast work to make sure that doesn't happen anymore. And, Madam Chair, I'm going to follow up with our own corrections department to make sure that we don't have any convicted sex offenders getting Viagra.
Actually, this, Senator Walker, this is a fairly broad relating clause I see that we have here. So,
no, Madam Chair.
Perhaps there are other reasons for holding this off to another day.
I think you're very correct and very observant. That must be exactly why I put this in the bill file.
It must have been, Senator Walker. You're very astute on that. Okay, we will close the work session on House Bill 2144. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2299. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2299 requires a person who is relieved of their duty to report as a sex offender by a court to provide to the Department of the State Police a copy of that court order relieving the person of their duty. There is a Dash 1 amendment with this bill. If adopted, it incorporates what was House Bill 2296 into this bill, and would add to the sex offender registration requirements that a registered sex offender would have to report within 10 days of their first day of working at or carrying on a vocation at or attending an institution of higher education or within 10 days of a change in that work, vocation, or attendance. Of course, then, because that becomes a registration requirement, there are conforming changes adding the requirement as conditions of probation, parole, and post-prison supervision, and adding the failure to report the involvement with the institution of higher education to the statute that criminalizes failing to report as a sex offender. I would note for the committee that one of the concerns that came up with House Bill 2296 on the House side that I promised the members would be addressed here, or at least that I would raise here, is the definition of institution of higher education. And so when Mr. Malin comes up, perhaps he can address that as well. 2296 because, right. But that's the Dash 1 amendments now today on 2299. I'm sorry.
It's actually Ms. Satinspiel who will probably address that.
Thank you.
So let us have Dan Malin and Lori Satinspiel come up. I was determined to get to this bill today since you two have shown up about three times. My apologies. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about House Bill 2299. Both the original bill and the Dash 1 amendment flowed from issues that were raised at the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee hearings last March a year ago, actually, of 2004. The 2299 piece is... I consider it to be a housekeeping piece. In the last legislative session, the legislature passed a change
to the statutes for a juvenile who was seeking relief from sex offender registration. That resulted in the crafting of Oregon Revised Statute 181607. That statute had a piece in it that required a person so relieved to provide a certified copy of the relief order to the state police to facilitate their removal from the state sex offender registry. The two other statutes that deal with relief from sex offender registration, ORS 181600 and 608, did not have that language. So this simply makes anyone who is relieved of sex offender registration obligation required to send that certified copy of the order to the registry so we can have them removed. The Dash 1 amendment speaks to the federal law, which is the Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act. It was originally brought to the legislature in the 2003 session, but did not get completed before the end of session. This law, federal law, was enacted in September of 2003, and it requires all states to require any person who's required to register as a sex offender in that state to perform an additional registration when they work at an institution of higher education or attend school at an institution of higher education or carry on a vocation. We had lengthy discussions with the Attorney General's office when the federal law came out to determine the language of carrying on a vocation, and that would apply to a person who, for instance, maybe comes onto the campus 10 or 12 times a year during the course, for instance, of a sporting event, sells souvenirs or refreshments or whatever the case might be. In other words, they're not a permanent employee of the campus, but they are coming onto the campus occasionally during the course of the year. Could also apply to someone who, for instance, provides contract landscaping service to the institution. Excuse me. So that's why we have the piece about carrying on a vocation. Besides the existing registration requirements in the state of Oregon, which are anyone that's convicted of a sex crime in this state or adjudicated as a juvenile for one of the sex crimes, or who moves to this state after having been convicted in another state of a sex crime or being adjudicated as a juvenile, they have to register within 10 days of their release from prison, release on probation, discharge by the court, or arrival into the state of Oregon. This would require them to do an additional registration within 10 days of attending college or institution of higher education or starting to work at one of those campuses or carrying on that vocation. During the last legislative session, there was, from the United States Department of Justice, a potential burn grant forfeiture if the states did not comply with the federal law. Since that time, the burn grants have been modified into the justice assistance grants, and states are still required to comply with previous amendments to the Wetterling Act, which is the federal law that requires registration, but we no longer have a penalty if we don't comply with this federal law. So that penalty no longer exists, and that's according to our grants administrator at Oregon State Police. The Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act was adopted after several female college students became the victims of sexually motivated murders throughout the nation, including crimes in Oregon and Washington. At issue is the fact that information concerning registered sex offenders is available to the public upon request, but the information provided is based on offenders who reside within a specific area or concerning a specific offender, and that's right out of the statute on release of information on sex offenders. In many cases, students and workers on campuses don't reside within the zip code of the institution. As an example, if a registered sex offender from Springfield attends classes at or works on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene, the fact that the registrant is on the campus is not readily available to the public or, in some cases, to the institution. If you requested a list of offenders in the University of Oregon or 97403 zip code, this offender would not be on the list, although he would likely appear on the 97477 or other Springfield zip code list. So that's why the basis for this law. People can be on campuses, they can be sex offenders, no one can be aware of it.
This bill resolves the problem by requiring the additional registration. The sex offender registration unit would have to modify the registration forms. We would have to modify the state sex offender registry database because we would likely want to be able to provide to a requester the list of offenders who are on a specific campus or at a specific institution. Right now, we can query the database for a number of data fields, but that is not one of them. The current registration form has a data field or a line for employer/school, and we capture that information, but offenders don't always put their employment information and they don't always put the school that they're attending on there. It's just a fact. They're afraid that if they put their employment information on there, they might lose their job. So this law would require them to actually fill out that information, provide that information, do an extra registration, and then that information would be available. Not only did the federal law amend the Wetterling Act, it also amended the Higher Education Act of 1965, and it requires the institutions to notify their campus community where they can obtain information about sex offenders on their campus. In the hearings over on the House side, that started to go in a direction of the institutions notifying the public about sex offenders on their campus. And if we went in that direction, we would have to change the release of information on sex offender statute, because when we get to notification in the state only applies to predatory sex offenders and not all sex offenders. So there's a number of pieces that we have questions about with this law, but we do support the law, and we think that it's important for the citizens of the state of Oregon, the people who work on the campuses and the campus communities, to be able to obtain information about offenders who are on the campuses. Our estimated fiscal that we attached to this was $3,000, and that's about how much it would cost us to modify the database. As far as changing the forms is concerned, that's a simple matter of working it out with the state printing plant. And I'll cut my testimony off. No, we're short on time.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Lori Satinsville, the Oregon Community College Association, representing 17 community colleges in Oregon, which serve 330,000 Oregonians. 53% of those are women. I don't have a lot to add to what you've already heard about the bill. We're in support of House Bill 2299 and especially the Dash Ones. It's important for our colleges to be able to help students and employees with the information they might be looking for, and that's about all I have to add to this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else want to testify on this? We will close the hearing on House Bill 2299. Okay, I think we're going to we will put over the rest of the agenda except for Senate Bill 65, which got there by mistake today. And I think that only is one or two bills. See, 2142, three bills. Can you read those?
Yes. 2142A, 2297, and 2361.
Okay, we will put those over till. Do we have a crowded agenda tomorrow?
No, I don't know.
We'll put those over till tomorrow's agenda. They may have to be put over again, but we'll put those till tomorrow's agenda. And Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Committee, we need to hear from you on.